Okay. Going back to the actual literary style of the poems as we have it. Well, the images are drawn very abundantly from nature. We have gazelles and hinds, birds and foxes, sheep and goats. The gifts of nature abound. There's wine and incense and cedars and cypresses and grapes and pomegranates. So this is all very vivid and all very sensual, and also seems to talk about wealth and prosperity, because you're not going to be enjoying all these things unless you're comfortably off, if not wealthy. So after having gone round the houses with the various theories, the most straightforward view of the Song of Songs is that really it is a collection of love songs, and that the allegorizing is perhaps you know, something one may do, but that it probably was not really where they began. The various commentators, both Jewish and Christian, often seem to think that erotic poetry is itself too indecent for inclusion in the Bible. One must observe that there was much candor in ancient Israel about concerning love and sexual processes, and often we hear that in various stories, even though this may be considered bad taste in polite society nowadays. Good taste and basic morality must not be confused. This is Puritanism, says one of the commentators. So while the language of the Song of Songs may be too explicit for modern ears, it doesn't make it necessarily morally offensive. A second point is that the subject of erotic poetry need not be illicit love. It's not necessarily what we would call perhaps pornography. But that the love which is at the base of marriage is good in any sound morality. It is not just good, but even holy. In Catholic theology, we should remember that the consent given in marriage, which signifies the giving of one's body to another, is identified by the Church, indeed, with the sacrament of marriage, and that the marriage is not truly a marriage until it is consummated. So this is perhaps what is being discussed. There is no reason why this matrimonial giving of one's body and receiving of another should not be the object of praise in a sacred book, and why this praise should not include the joy and love and delight which one may experience is a good question. Unless the joy and love are themselves morally wrong, then the praise of them can scarcely be morally wrong. So the modern interpreters are therefore more inclined to see the Song of Songs as a collection of love lyrics, not necessarily arranged into a pattern or a parable, but something which simply affirmed the goodness and joy of sexual love and the affirmation that this is not in opposition to the highest ideals of Christian morality. So what's the theological importance of this? Well, the traditional Christian interpretation of the Song of Songs arose from a Christocentric understanding of the Old Testament. That is, as we said before, it's symbolic of the relationship of Christ and the Church, or Christ to the individual soul. that may be reading something in a way which can be legitimate, but a thing that I think is important to remember is that the Old Testament scripture has its own legitimacy even before the coming of Christ, because for the Jewish people it's still alive, important, real, and divine. So I think we need to hear the text on its sort of historical level. Israel resisted the divinization of sexuality characteristic of much of the ancient Near East, and characteristic again of its, especially the Canaanite fertility cults, which we heard denounced frequently by the prophets. The Lord had no female consort. It wasn't a sort of male and female together who created. Not like we don't have Isis and Osiris in Egypt, for example. We just have God who created by God's speech. If you look back to the creation story, God spoke and it came to be. It is the word of God which is creative, rather than that there is some kind of divine sexual union which gives rise to either other creatures or to the world. But human sexual love was seen as something intrinsically good, and it could even be a symbol of divine love. The Song of Songs therefore presents us with a biblical model of human intimacy. The mutuality and fidelity between lovers, the sensuousness of their relationship, their devotion to each other, clearly emerge from the canticles, and they are good. So it is widely held that the sages of Israel are responsible for its for keeping it and transmitting it, because they saw in it really a sound expression of the values of human love. And probably they were married men themselves, and they remember when they were younger and wanted to pass it on. I mean, I think this is worth remembering too, that celibacy was not... St. Bernard was a celibate monk, and the rabbis were married men, and so they would probably have quite a different viewpoint on the matters, of course, on the discussion. Christianity can be grateful for this insight, especially in the light of some of the early Gnostic doctrines, which were extremely hostile towards the body and to sexuality. For example, a lot of the early Gnostics said that once you became a Christian, even if you were married, you should just never have sex again. And of course, they tended to die out because they had no children to pass on their faith to. There was no such thing as a director of elementary faith development for the Gnostics, because they didn't have children. So...
I would imagine that would also cut down on the number of converts.
Well, it did. And then, you know, the kind of tendency towards Puritanism is often one where for reasons of trying to maintain a good morality, that one can push too hard and actually deny the goodness of something which finds its place in marriage. Another comment one could say about this is you could look at the Song of Songs as some kind of expansion or commentary on the Genesis chapter 1 and 2, which each in their different ways talks about the creation of the world, the creation of man and woman, the origins of marriage, and that the joy and delight that the first man and woman found in each other. So that's about it in terms of background, and I suggest that we might just, as we always do, look through the book, which is relatively short, and see what we can find.
Well, some of it is actually quite humorous when you look at it in chapter 4. Your hair is like a flock of goats streaming down the mountains of Gilead.
Yeah.
And your teeth are like a flock of ewes to be shorn. I mean, when you picture that, and somebody I heard said...
Washed and shorn. I mean, they do make a point that they had been
washed.
Yeah.
However, I heard that if you've ever seen goats coming down a mountain, they come one by one. So the assumption is that her hair is rather lank and sparse. So, I mean, when you look at this, there are, to me, that's very humorous.
Well, in fact, in order to underline this point, I have found a cartoon that somebody has drawn, taking all these features and putting them together.
Oh, wow.
So I will pass this around, and
okay.
Had I got here a little sooner, I would have made copies. So there she is with her goats and her
covered out.
Tower of
I'd have a
ivory
problem
net.
With my husband comparing me to a goat.
Goats
under any circumstance.
Goats are prized possessions.
I'm sorry.
Well, that is true.
I still
wouldn't
like my teeth being cold like ewes wanting to be
but,
shorn.
I mean, generally,
like,
where
my toothbrush.
There are some very beautiful images,
twins,
but this is just
so
one of them.
Big teeth.
That's very funny.
Yeah, it is.
I think he's have to work out of that one.
Well, I think, again, defending the biblical writers, a lot of it is about prosperity.
Right.
And it's always a wish, I think, when a couple gets married, you know, may you be happy, may you have children, may you be prosperous.
Yeah,
and
you have all your teeth.
Yeah, well, exactly. And one of the points made is in an era of very little dental hygiene, to actually have all your teeth was considered to be quite something special.
I still say Mark would have to dig his way out of the doghouse on that one.
I haven't left.
Great little animal. Mark knows better than comparing me to any animal or he's in trouble.
I mean, you can almost hear it read. It's there are some really some very beautiful images.
Wasn't there a book, something about the song of the dove is heard in our land? Isn't that the title of it? I mean, when I read it, I thought, I've read that before. You know, like it's something. Does anybody else recall that? Or?
Something about eyes being like doves,
that
they
were.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I
saw.
I think that has been lifted as a book title somewhere. Maybe 20, 30 years ago, something like that.
Talking of book titles, this is one of the famous expressions in this. Towards the end, is "Love is as strong as death," and where are we?
Yeah,
yeah. Set me as a seal on your heart, a seal on your arm, for stern as death is love, relentless as the netherworld is devotion. And this is a novel, Love is Strong as Death, written by Bill Powers, who actually is a good friend of mine, and he's a parishioner at the Newman Center. And so he has taken very deliberately one of the most famous and telling phrases from the Song of Songs. And as I went through it earlier, in the preparations, I kept finding song titles and so on that I know from people who. I think that because of it's one of the great classics of Romantic literature. Many people have used it as a jumping off point. There's Bruce Springsteen has a song called "The Secret Garden," and Bruce Springsteen is a good Catholic, of course, and Catholic anyway. And so I think he just jumped off from this, the Secret Garden idea, to write another sort of romantic song which is has biblical allusions. So indeed, several of us have mentioned how a lot of the phrases look familiar. For that reason.
I was just looking. Sometimes they put the quote in the front or something like that. I don't see it. Oh, here it is. I see right under it. Sent me this one. Mm-hmm. Yeah, love is strong. That's a little different than it says in our version, but the message is the same. So. Is there any significance to the fact, where he says she's like a lily among thorns, and she says he's like an apple among the forest, and how sweet it was that he was giving it to her, and I was wondering if his fruit to her, I'm wondering if this had any Adam and Eve kind of connotation, do you think? Or
well, I would certainly think so.
They could have picked a plum tree or whatever like that.
Well, remember that it wasn't an apple tree in the Garden of Eden. It was not named.
Yeah.
It was just said to be a fruit. And by custom, I think we describe them as apples. I'd like to go back to this head to foot and foot to the head thing that is mentioned. So if we go to chapter 4,
mm-hmm.
And that this is... a parallel with a particular Arabic type of song which the sort of bride and groom sing to each other. So it starts off, he talking to her, the beginning of chapter 4.
Mm.
Ah, you are beautiful, my beloved. Ah, you are beautiful. Your eyes are doves. So we're starting at the top.
Mm-hmm.
Your eyes are doves behind your veil. Your hair is like a flock of goats streaming down the mountains of Gilead. Your teeth are a flock of ewes to be shorn, which come up to the washing, all of them big with twins, none of them thin and barren. So here again, this is very
mm-hmm.
much a sort of marital blessing of
mm-hmm.
fertility. Your lips are like a scarlet strand, your mouth is lovely, your cheek is like a half pomegranate behind your veil. So we're moving downwards. Your neck is like David's tower, girt with battlements, 1,000 bucklers hang upon it, all the shields of valiant men. Your breasts are like twin fawns, the young of a gazelle that browse among the lilies. Until the day breathes cool and the shadows lengthen, I will go to the mountains of myrrh, to the hill of incense. You are all beautiful, my beloved. There is no blemish in you. Chapter 5, verse 10. Now it's she who is singing.
Mm-hmm.
My lover is radiant and ruddy. He stands out among thousands. His head, aha, we're starting at the top again, is pure gold. His locks are palm fronds, black as the raven. His eyes are like doves beside running waters. His teeth would seem bathed in milk and are set like jewels.
Mm-hmm.
His cheeks are like beds of spice with ripening aromatic herbs. His lips are red blossoms. They drip choice myrrh. His arms are rods of gold adorned with chrysolites. His body is a work of ivory covered with sapphires. His legs are columns of marble resting on golden bases. So we've gone from head to foot.
He's better looking than she is.
Yes, I'd rather have my teeth compared to the milk.
He doesn't have a nose that
much
like a tower.
Well, he's ivory and marble and cheek coats.
And gold.
Yeah, sapphires and everything.
Well, okay, now it's going from going upwards. If you begin chapter 7, so this is the other one where we actually, how beautiful, chapter 7, verse 2, okay, we start with the feet. How beautiful are your feet in sandals, your rounded thighs like jewels, your navel going up, 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 your navel is a round bowl, your body a heap of wheat, your breasts like twin fawns, your neck is a tower of ivory, your nose is like the tower on Lebanon that looks towards Damascus, your head rises like Carmel. So I think that the main point really is that it's this particular scholar discovered this parallel in this particular sort of Arabic wedding song, which is seems to be the case even today. So it's just situating what we've seen in the sort of ancient Near Eastern literature more broadly.
Yeah, maybe I'm just a crude or something, but I always thought stuff like this was supposed to be kind of private between you and your husband.
They used to have a week of celebration of dining and dancing and all this for at every wedding before they actually got married. I mean, so there was at such a great, you just know there would be all kinds of banter going back and forth. I mean, the bride
and groom going to the tent and the people go in and out. It's a different culture, and it makes it more legitimate
in the Bible, I think. Somebody said, I don't know if I missed it tonight, I forget, but it was mentioned somewhere in the readings about how, remember how sex was part of God worship in a lot of the other Eastern religions, make something like this part of religion. I mean, the Jews, as we know, were contaminated, if you will, or took into their culture a lot of practices from the people whom they invaded and conquered and took the promised land from.
I'm not sure they were tainted. I think that's just part of the culture, the way it was. I mean, when you read Genesis, Adam and Eve were naked. It was part of the culture. I don't think there was any kind of stigma attached.
I think part of the story with Adam and Eve, etc., is that that was before the fall, and afterwards, one of the
we saw kind of an ideal picture,
and certain things went wrong. You know, one, he had to go out to work. Number two, she had pain in childbearing and so on, because they were just like children running around without a care in the world.
They found out they were naked.
But also there was still this a kind of recognition of the goodness of human sexuality, which we are looking at something after having had Tertullian and Augustine and St. Peter Damian and all these very puritanical Christian interpreters over several centuries, and that I mean, it's not what one finds in the culture. I mean, for example, it's part of Jewish tradition to this day that is considered a very good way of husband and wife to celebrate this Sabbath is to make love on the Sabbath. Now, not in front of the children, but with each other. So it's considered a good thing to do.
And not in church.
Now, on the other hand, if you were to read...
I was raised never on a Sunday, okay?
Well, they would say always on the Sabbath, so it's quite a different attitude. And I think sometimes...
My grandmother would be flipping circles.
Well, I think there's a kind of a Christian heresy that, you know, human nature was created by God, apart from that little bit in the middle that was actually created by the devil. Because our attitude often is not counting sexuality in part of God's creative goodness, and it's something which has been, one can trace through the history of Christian theology how the idea is developed, and partly it goes back to Saint Augustine, who said, Augustine believed the sex was always sinful, even between husband and wife, except that if number one, they were just intent on having a baby, and number two, they absolutely didn't enjoy it in the least. No, I'm not making this up. And no. This actually was the foundation.
He was celibate, right?
Well, that's
eventually.
It's like the British.
Well, he had a concubine when he was a young man before he became
a
Christian.
He must
not have been very good.
And he had a son
to whom
he was very devoted.
That's right.
And his son died when he was about 17, and Augustine was absolutely heartbroken. But once Augustine became a Christian, he really became, I mean, he wasn't a sort of very promiscuous, but he had a concubine, and that was considered kind of a normal thing for a young man to do in those days. And the idea was you have a concubine while you're a student at college, and then when you're older, you marry a woman of wealth, and the concubine just gets kind of thrown aside, and that was the usual Roman custom.
Isn't he the one whose mother didn't want to have him baptized until he was old enough because of the... before he was baptized, he could commit sins, and then after...
Well, that was common in the first Christian centuries.
Right.
I mean, there was no RCIA for children then, and there was no infant baptism really until Augustine's time. And... But Augustine's theology, his very pessimistic theology of sexuality, became kind of normal within Christianity from the 5th century until the Second Vatican Council. So
he's the one that we have to thank for all this.
Well, a lot of, again, when we mostly read the Old Testament, reading it through a sort of sequence of lenses of interpretation, we don't just get the text as it is, because, of course, one thing, we don't read Hebrew, we're reading it in English.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of sort of layers of interpretation from, you know, Judaism through early Christianity through later Catholicism, through what we were taught by the nuns in school or by our parents and until today. And all of those have an effect, and it's difficult, and we're trying to do it at least a little bit in the Denver Bible study, of going back to something about the original culture, which is why reading the commentaries is helpful. But even so, we're still reading it as 21st century Catholics reading something which is 2,500 years before our time and comes from a society with very, very different customs and assumptions. And also because in the scriptures we don't see everything. We see those part which are in the scriptures, and there was a whole lot of kind of everyday life and customs which may not have been recorded in the scriptures but still had a very important bearing on people's way of life and viewpoint.
I mean, I don't have a problem with that intimacy is good in a marriage, but I just have a problem with in public, you know. It's not something that would come up in common conversation, and so having
I
this kind of stuff, I'm just kind of
not.
Like, holy heck, you know, nothing was private, eh?
Well, I think that it may well have been, if these were, as the theory puts it, sort of wedding songs, it might be that you know, they'd all had a little wine to drink, and they would sing it with great sort of ribald gusto, and then the couple would blush a little bit, then they'd sneak off at the end of the wedding reception, which was a week rather than just one evening. So that's, you know, speculation of which I know very little. But except again that you know, still in that part of the world, the wedding celebrations go on for a week, and there's a lot of the same sort of royal ceremonial in a way, and people spend a fortune compared to, you know, people who are generally quite poor on a wedding celebration, making it look grand and including all the many, many people in the extended family.
I have to get in my usual pediatric plug here.
Yep.
8-8. Our sister is little and she has no breasts yet. What shall we do for her sister when her courtship begins? You know, as though you could hasten it along in some way. But then they talk about protecting her, you know, because she's not ready yet.
She's not ready to be there.
Putting a door and a wall and all this sort of thing. And before that they said, do not arouse, do not love before its own time, which I think is a temporizing kind of a statement, you know, too.
Well, I think that's certainly true, and the attitude seemed to be in the ancient Near East, and for that matter, the modern Near East, is the very, very strict prohibitions on misuse of sexuality, but on the other hand, within marriage, it seemed to be much more positively appreciated, rather than in Western Christianity, it seemed to be a kind of a very general Puritanism, which has been attacked in more recent years to become a general licentiousness, where I mean, this is something of a simplification, that often it was. You know, Christianity had often said, well, sex is bad always,
mm-hmm.
and the critics mm-hmm. have said, no, sex is good always, whereas in the ancient East they said, well, sex is good, but not before time and not with anyone you're not married to. So it perhaps is in some senses a healthier attitude, and we seem to have taken this and kind of grasped the sensuality and forgotten the fidelity in lots of ways. A couple of days ago, well, only last night here in church, there was the youth ministry had invited Mary Ronan to speak
mm-hmm.
on chastity. I don't know if could you come?
No, because Mel still just gone off the trail.
Yeah. She was very good. She's a nurse, and she did a lot of health education in high schools, and she kept being asked to kind of explain things to children that their parents didn't want to, and I thought she had a very healthy attitude. One thing she brought with her was a lot of magazine covers, and she showed them and the various things that they were getting teenagers to try and think about or do, and she was very critical of those. But she was coming back to a healthy appreciation of sexuality, but one which is definitely behind closed doors and definitely only with one spouse, you know, the same person who is going to take the effort to care for the children and earn a living and come back to you tomorrow and all these expressions of trustworthiness and fidelity. So perhaps the fact that it's there in the canon of scripture acts as some kind of corrective to a tendency towards too much Puritanism. It's one of God's surprises to us.
Well, he wrote quite a bit. I mean, I've got this, and I looked under, because he has a couple, most of the descriptions are maybe a page or so on, but he ties it.